welcome to Worlds Apart. The conflict in Ukraine has opened up a new chapter in Russia's relations, not only with Kyiv or the West, but also with many other countries near and far. The former Soviet republics are particularly sensitive both to the risks of the Ukrainian scenario and to the opportunities that the geostrategic location allows them amidst the shifting world order. How skillful are they in playing their cards? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Beg Rahimov, Executive Director of the Center for Strategic Solutions Aplikata in Kyrgyzstan.
Thank you so much for your time. I'd like to start by addressing the name of your organization, which to me feels very ambitious. Many countries today find themselves at an intersection between great risks and major opportunities, hence the need to make some genuinely strategic decisions. So let's start with somewhat of a philosophical question. What does it mean for you to think strategically? What kind of skills or expertise does it require?
That's a difficult question. First, I'd like to point out that what we have is more than just a center for strategic solutions.
So it's about applied strategic solutions.
Yes, but there is more than one dimension to it. From our school algebra course, we know about the X and Y axes. But some forget about the third one, which is the Z axis, otherwise known as the
aplikata. And the three of them must intersect in a practical sense.
Yes, they must intersect at a certain starting point. And it's the third axis that provides objectivity. Which is why, in any strategy, the important thing is to see the full picture, and that is something you get by looking at it from a distance.
But objectively is an ideal, perfect category. Only God has access to objective reality. Anyway, if look at politics or geopolitics, how does that apply?
You know, there's a technique in mathematics called the maximum likelihood estimation. It's a mathematical method of estimation. When you deal with strategy, with strategic decision-making, you can, and even ought to rely on maximum likelihood estimation. In other words, you need to arrive at a formula which takes into account most of the relevant factors in order to see the picture as it is. And this is how you direct your political strategy.
I'm not trying to disagree with you, but don't you think that this is something that small and medium-sized countries have to deal with? Because the most important country on the planet, the United States, the hegemon, operates on the principle that perception is reality. Whatever you perceive to be real is real. What the reality is on the ground is of secondary importance. What matters is what we want to see. Is there a distinction here in terms of the size of countries and their level of ambition? Or do you still think that everyone has to deal with reality to a certain extent?
That's a good question. It's worth thinking about. But I leave that there is no such thing as the truth as formulated on one single continent. Because strategies are always based on the nation's interests. We all have different interests. And it's important to understand that strategies can be paradoxical, they can be proactive, or they can be passive. In this case, the Russian strategy over the past few years, what I call factor 0222, has been a proactive strategy.
Let's take a look at it, especially since you're an expert on Central Asia. I think we can agree that regardless of anyone's geopolitical views, Russia's military campaign in Ukraine came as a major shock to the entire post-Soviet region, including, for that matter, Russia itself. What once seemed impossible is now reality, and this has already started to affect both analysis and planning. Would you say that this has changed the approach to the Central Asian countries to building their international relations across the board?
Absolutely. On the margins of our Central Asian Conference of the Valdai Club, we once again heard the famous Asian formula: hot economics, cold politics. And despite all the alarmism, trade growth is measured in tens of percent, at least within the Eurasian Economic Union, within the CIS. To be honest, I don't really like the name Commonwealth of Independent States. It's redundant. After all, independence is an attribute of statehood in itself. Still, this is the hand we were dealt by history, the brainchild of Mr. Kravchuk, Mr. Yeltsin, and our colleague from Belarus.
Everything in this world is relative, especially independence.
So speaking of the shock, yes, it really was a shock. And after the global shock came what I would call aftershocks. We can already see them manifest themselves in various ways. But over this time, over the past 2.5 years, we've all learned to listen and to hear one another. And it turned out to be an invaluable skill, a skill that emerges in times of extreme stress.
I think that even in Soviet times, the Central Asian culture of governance, of bureaucracy, of politics, was substantially different from, say, the Ukrainian political culture. I'd say they have just the opposite situation, hot politics and cold economics, if you look at the present period. And yet, I would like to ask you, what, if I may put it this way, is the main lesson to be learned from the Ukrainian case for the Central Asian countries? After all, they are, too, at an intersection of major global and geopolitical interests.
Mr. Lukyanov put it very well. We cannot be impartial at this moment because we are still inside the process. I can only repeat his words. It is still very difficult to say anything about these lessons. Why? Because the situation is still in full swing, and we are in the middle of it. All I can do is be vague and say that the conclusions are yet to be drawn, but we are already learning some useful tactical lessons.
For example,
that the configuration after the collapse of the Soviet Union is not final, and it's impossible to account for all interests. The breakup of a country like the USSR is not the same as breaking a mirror. When you've got the fractal principle and each shard remains a reflection of the same mirror. With the Soviet Union, this wasn't the case. There are, therefore, several ways of looking at how to move forward. You either try to reassemble the mirror or recognize that each shard now exists independently. But what do we do then with a reflection that is still there?
In one of your articles, you said that unlike the former republics of the Soviet Union on the western border, the Central Asian republics treat the Soviet past differently. They treat the Russian language differently, in a more utilitarian, practical way, in a sense. Do you think that this is mostly the case among the older generation, or is it passed on?
It's good that you've touched on this, because for average citizens of Central Asia, speaking Russian and being a part of Russian civilization is also a guarantee that they can get a job, that they will be able to feed themselves and their families. So there is that, the practical aspect.
But the practical aspect is often the most important.
Really a matter of pragmatism. The same is true, for example, when it comes to the economic success of certain countries that are part of the British Commonwealth. It is directly related to the fact that English was kept as a second language, an official language. Thanks to that, people from South Asia, for example, could integrate quite successfully into British society, all the way up to the elite level, like becoming the Mayor of London or the Prime Minister of the UK. And we see a comparable scenario in the former Soviet Union. In fact, the centrifugal process there started not that long ago, just 33 years ago. The Russian language is an important connecting factor for Central Asia. It is, in a way, an inter-civilizational glue, and at the same time, it is part of the underlying framework, the bones.
You know what worries me here? It seems to me that in the Ukrainian issue, language, culture, and some historical ties have been treated very ideologically, excluding the practical aspect of life, which is simply advantageous for having good relations with neighbors. Do you think practicality is returning to relations between states, and is it more visible today?
You know, I've been involved in issues of Eurasian integration for quite some time, and I want to say that without practicality and pragmatism, everything can unfortunately turn into empty words. This is what is called the integration of elites. Until these processes are filled with the concerns of ordinary people, or at least business interests, that is, when the economy begins to work for the common good, only then can we say that the space will not be destroyed. I would also like to say that the Ukrainian case is unique. I would not apply it to the rest of the post-Soviet space, as some experts, analysts, political scientists do. There are too many buts.
This is the pivot to the East that Russian political scientists have been discussing for quite some time, both the Far East and the nearest East. It is actually beginning to take shape, including the Central Asia. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the Russian government has become much more sensitive, perhaps even somewhat respectful and maybe even accommodating in its relations with its neighbors, especially those neighbors that are strategically important to it. How well are these signals being received and understood in the Central Asian capitals? Does Central Asia realize that it currently has leverage to strengthen its position, including in the eyes of Russia?
Yes. There's an understanding that it's not just about taking advantage of the situation, but also about restoring what was undeservedly pushed aside at some point. Regarding Russia and its policy focusing on Asia, I want to say the following. The term pivot to the East is not quite accurate. Why? Because two-thirds of Russia's territory is in Asia. It's already one of the largest Asian countries. Where do you pivot if you're already an Asian country?
Well, that's geographically true. However, you know very well that many Russian elites culturally, historically, and economically consider themselves part of Europe. I wanted to ask you about this. Do you think the more willing rhetorical alignment with Asia is primarily defensive? Like, Europe doesn't really welcome us, so we'll turn to Asia. Or is it an authentic process that includes Russia's deep self-identification?
I agree with you that it can be approached from the perspective of looking both ways, as symbolized by the double-headed eagle on the coat of arms, which looks both east and west. However, I think we are currently in a unique period of returning to this self-identification, to the realization of a special Eurasian path where the East and West organically intertwine. But for this, it is necessary to understand our selfhood and Asia-centricity. In one of my articles, I described several Asias for Russia. Broadly speaking, there is the mythical, faraway fairy tale land of Asia, and there's our own Asia, located in the Far East and Siberia.
Well, even in the Caucasus, there is a touch of Asia.
Yes, and the Asia we call Central Asia, which I refer to as Middle Asia. Here, we need to move forward, rethink, and not be afraid to venture into dead ends or engage in debates.
Thank you for mentioning the word selfhood, because the search for selfhood is always a very complex process and never starts with ready-made solutions. But we do have one ready solution right now. We need to take a short break, but we will be back in a few seconds. Stay with us.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Kubatbek Rahimov, Executive Director of the Center for Strategic Solutions, Aplikata, in Kyrgyzstan.
Mr. Rahimov, before the break, we were discussing Russia's eastern pivot or realization of its position in the east. While Russia is reorienting towards the east, it seems to me that Central Asian countries are increasingly looking towards the west. Last year marked the first summit of Central Asian leaders with the U.S. President. President Macron also visited the region. What do you think Central Asian countries are seeking in their relations with the West? And what is the West seeking in its relations with them?
The question delves into the same realm of pragmatism. Because for Russia, Central Asia is valuable due to its demographic potential. We've already reached half of Russia's population, and the growth rates are quite high. I believe that soon we'll reach nearly 100 million people. Meanwhile, for other countries, perhaps the importance lies in natural resources, commodities, or geopolitical considerations.
Or the military aspect.
I'm framing this within geopolitics. Regarding natural resources, everything is clear. Supplies, for instance, of Kazakhstan's oil, uranium, gas from Turkmenistan, gold. It's quite an extensive list. And China has a unique interest in this region. As a neighbor, if you look at it that way, it borders three Central Asian countries and interested in many aspects of cooperation, including reducing potential tensions related to Islamic extremism, which is a concern for China. And the U.S. often uses this region as a tool to pressure its historical neighbors, namely Russia and China.
But was that in the past, or is it still a trend?
It remains a trend. Unfortunately, it's still there. It feels like they read it in a textbook once and continue following it, just as Brzezinski wrote, or Huntington in the Clash of Civilizations. They read it at their universities and have followed this template ever since. But the world has changed.
But still, I already mentioned the summit of Central Asian leaders held by Biden in New York. Maybe Biden is reading the same textbook, but the elites in Central Asia are evolving. They now observe the events in the region more closely, maybe with a greater understanding of history. The Central Asian countries ready to be turned into a tool or a platform for American policy in this region?
You know, I think no one would be pleased to realize they are a pawn in someone else's game.
Ukraine seems comfortable in this role for now.
Therefore, a clear understanding of who the geopolitical actors are and who the agents or subjects and objects are probably makes life easier. Wouldn't you agree? An understanding of historical continuity and interconnectedness is needed to preserve the population. That is, if you make mistakes, you'll lose people. You'll lose the nation, as we are now seeing in the case of Ukraine. In our case, I'll repeat, everything is going well. The population growth rates show that our people are looking towards the future. And despite everything, we are not stagnant, not standing still. Because if we were, our standard of living would be falling, but it's not. In virtually all five countries of the region, things are going well in this regard. It's a natural and sensible aspiration to be allied with those who listen, hear, and make mutually acceptable win-win decisions. That's the right path to take. Therefore, the C5 Plus format you mentioned was first launched by the Japanese, if I remember correctly, by Shinzo Abe. After that, all the other countries interested in this region picked it up. But only a few players have attempted to turn things around. But the countries that can put to good use such matters as pragmatism, history, and interconnectedness in the region are probably Russia, China, India, and Iran.
By the way, you wrote that both Russia and China would like to see Central Asia as part of not the West, but not anti-West either, but rather part of a space free from Western hegemony, and yet not completely cut off off economically or even politically and culturally from Europe or even the US. In this regard, do you think these countries could play a cushioning or even a bridging role between the collective West and, not to say the collective East, but the East, which is also coming together in some way?
This is a complicated issue because we see how the global world is changing. On the one hand, it's true that we are dividing into geopolitical and geoeconomic blocks, which is a normal process. On the other hand, interactions are still ongoing. Sometimes certain territories, countries, or groups of countries can act as a damper or bridge, and sometimes even as a hub. In this case, after the factor of 0-22 came into play, the trade turnover between the Central Asian countries and Europe, the US and Japan has grown many-fold. Everyone is aware that we are reselling these goods to Russia, but no sanctions have been taken against us at the global level. None of the Central Asian countries are officially under sanctions. There are some private companies that have been slapped with certain restrictions, but that's about it. If we were playing against all the existing rules, it would likely create more problems for us. But as it stands, we are probably demonstrating that not all is lost, and dialogue should continue.
I've heard you say in one of your speeches that the geopolitical actors' interest in Central Asia is now comparable to that of the early 21st century when the Americans entered Afghanistan and needed a springboard, a so-called lily pad base in the region. How interesting is the region to Russia and China in terms of its military potential? As I understand, just a few decades ago, they were interested in demilitarization. Has anything changed on this front?
From a military logistics point of view, Central Asia is, as the Americans say, a logistical nightmare. Why? Because
for Americans or for everyone?
For almost everyone. Why? Because of what we perceive as a disadvantage for us, the fact that we have no access to the sea in this kind of heartland region. It's a very inconvenient region for large-scale military operations, especially in terms of military logistics. You have to cross many borders and rely on air logistics. So you see,
you mean it's inconvenient for waging war?
Yes, that's why we...
To campaign in Afghanistan?
Exactly. The case of Afghanistan demonstrated that whenever Pakistan chose not to give a green light, for whatever reason, the traffic was rerouted via Central Asia, and that was impossible without transit through Russian territory. What an irony. The supplies were delivered to Afghanistan by Russian rail through Kyrgyzstan, where the railways ended and the supplies had to be reloaded onto trucks bound for Sherkhan Bandar. I personally inspected all those roads, and it was quite amusing to actually see that in terms of logistics, the military effort of the United States was at least 80% dependent on Russia's goodwill.
And yet, the absence of a full-scale war under this or that form of control is not the same as peace, full-scale development or Eurasian integration. What does the region need in order to finally make transition from the current state of neither peace nor war to something more attractive?
You know, this kind of approach probably worked before. It's not going to work now. As I already mentioned, the disintegration process that leads to a formation of smaller geopolitical blocks is already underway, and we'll probably go through quite a lot of turbulence in the coming decades when, whether we want it or not, we'll need to show our alliances or show our teeth and muscles, depending on the situation.
Speaking of Eurasian integration, we only have time for one more question now. And you mentioned that many experts are now wondering whether Eurasian economic integration is possible without Europe's involvement. Is development of the Eurasian space possible through the local effort, through the effort of the regional players only? What would be your answer to this question?
You know,
without Europe or the West?
It's quite possible without Europe or the West. Why? Because I see huge prospects along the track of a free trade zone agreement between the Eurasian Economic Union and China, the kind that's been recently signed with Iran. I also see prospects in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization undergoing a certain kind of a reset process that would involve launching new financial instruments, such as the SCO bank to start with, and building a space stretching from the city of Brest in Belarus, as opposed to France, to Vladivostok. That is, in fact, farther east than most of China's own provinces, if we speak of Russia's turn to the east. And I believe this is the direction to follow, because China and India together account for half the world, and Russia only stands to win on this track, not to lose. And it's going to be a win-win situation for both sides, not just a one-way street affair. It could involve a new stage of industrial development of the Central Asian countries, which would give Russia a chance to expand its social, economic, as well as political activity. In order to ease the tension around the situation with labor migration in Central Asia, it would make sense to use the kind of approach the Soviet Union applied, involving industrial or agricultural development of these territories. The climate is very good for agriculture there, but this kind of development certainly requires action backed by investment, which is why Russia needs to collaborate with China and possibly with India and Iran to run such large-scale infrastructure projects for industrial or agricultural development. And that's when we'll see a completely different world, and what we call today Eurasian integration will become something much bigger, something on a much higher level, and naturally it will produce results on a different scale.
Well, I guess time will tell. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.